Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Indie Comic Spotlight. This week, it's going to be a little bit different. Instead of it just being a deep dive into an indie comic you may have missed, or one of your favorites, it is that. But it's also, in typical superhero fashion, a backdoor pilot into more amazing superhero stuff. So, Matthew B. Lloyd, who was on a show earlier this year, we talked about Pep Comics, and then he showed up on Superhero for Dummies, and he talked about The Fly, and it just made sense, as we are Comics in Motion, your one-stop digest for all things comics. What we were missing was that voice to give us the history of comics, and we couldn't think of anybody better than Matthew B. Lloyd to be the voice of that. So this is technically Indie Comics Spotlight, episode 45, but it is also the backdoor pilot into Classic Comics with Matthew B. Lloyd, coming soon to Comics in Motion. Happy listening. The spirit. Will Eisner's The Spirit. I think we need to start, Matt, by talking about why. I don't know how many people know. Comic fans know the Eisner Awards, and they know maybe just tangentially what that means. I think a lot of times it's like, you know, awards get names and you don't really know what they are. So the Eisner Awards are, of course, named after Will Eisner, who created The Spirit. And so that's who we're going to talk about today. So why do you think, as the expert on all things classic comics, and we can all learn at the well of your genius, why do you think Will Eisner is the namesake of all comicdom? What do you think he did differently that other people didn't do?
Eisner was an innovator. He brought a depth of character, a depth of storytelling. He created, you know, sort of the vocabulary of how to tell comics in a more intelligent way, and not just sort of the content, but as well as the technique in moving you from panel to panel, that kind of thing. His splash pages in The Spirit, once he gets going, are, it's like a textbook of how to do a splash page. Well, let's look at this one. Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's amazing. And so many different storytelling techniques. I mean, this is started in 1940. So the way comics were told often were very, very simple. And even in the newspaper strips, which I have an affinity for, there wasn't as much variety available because you had to fit it into that 4 or 5 panel layout, and then your Sunday page. So there are some things that were different about that, but still, working in a regular comic book story that we're used to, he was one of the first ones to really do different kinds of things. And we'll see some of them today when we talk about some of the stories, I'm sure. The splash pages to jump out immediately, how the kinds of stories he told. He didn't really want to tell stories about, you know, cops and robbers and a good guy and a bad guy. That was his the character he used to tell the stories, but he was really telling stories about people. And of course he would go on to work for until, you know, he died telling stories, doing comics. And it was always about people. It was people he knew growing up, people inspired by his childhood. Sometimes something a little more less life-based, like a signal from space, also known as Life on Another Planet, which is about an alien invasion. But at the heart of it, it's really about the people and the way they react and those really human things. And, you know, you read a 10-page story of, you know, Batman from 1940, and you read a Spirit from a few years later, once he comes back from the war, and it's a, you know, totally different kind of storytelling.
Yeah, and we'll definitely talk about that change, because I think what cemented him is the post-war kind of PTSD version of Will Eisner that he was. I feel like The Spirit was his therapy, and I think we'll talk about that when we get to that part, but that's my feeling. That's just what I think. And I would like to hear your thoughts on that too. And again, I've not read them all. We're going to focus on, so The Spirit was reason this counts as our crossover is because the Spirit was obviously pre-everything. This is a true independent comic. It's been published by a bunch of different publishers. Harvey, didn't Wiz do it for a while? And then obviously DC put the collect, there's like 28 volumes of everything collected, the collected Spirit. We're just focusing on the best of, because that's the book that I could get hold of. And the best of is a great place to start. Number one, it's got an intro by Neil Gaiman. Hooray. But also, which is like a love letter. It was like, you could feel, because Neil, I'm a big Neil fan, but like the way that he like was overwhelmed by writing that, you know, about Will, because Will was dead when he wrote it. So it was just such a nice tribute to him. But I think the best of the Spirit, which is what we're going to focus on, it introduces us enough and it takes us through time.
Yeah.
And so it's a really great way to start. And then if you go back and get those collected works, you'll see these stories again, but with a little different context, because this, you're like jumping through time.
And there's a neat contrast. I am actually currently working through the war years that he didn't have any involvement in because he was in the army.
Right.
And there's a huge contrast. It's not that they're bad. They're just so different from that post-war era when he comes back and he's matured, he's had the experience of the war, and it's an amazing contrast. But I don't discount those war years. They're just really different. They just seem to fit in with your average comic from the 40s, average good comic, you know, we'll say good comic because it was the people at Quality that were filling in and doing that. And I mentioned before, and we spoke before, how good Quality comics were in the 40s. Great stuff.
Yeah. And I think like with anything, it's because the Spirit is Will Eisner's story. And this was also one of the innovative things is that, you know, like, I'm just, because you mentioned comic strips, when Bill Watterson decided to stop making Calvin and Hobbes, that was it. No one else was going to get to, no one else has ever made another Calvin and Hobbes. No one ever made another Far Side, you know, once Gary stopped. So like you think about the ownership that Will Eisner had for the Spirit, and yet it's also telling that he didn't technically, because when he left, it kept getting published. And that's how we also think of comics. So it was also this kind of innovative things like, oh, we can, other people can tell these stories too. You know, at the beginning, with Batman, Bob and Bill did all the stories. Bill did all the stories, we'll say, and Bob drew some and took a lot of credit for it. That's a whole different story. That's a different thing for a different time. But Bill Finger wrote all these Batman stories. And he trained his next people. So he tried to make it, you know, the same for years, but for Will to give that up, like the Spirit didn't go on hiatus when he was gone. So again, that's just another innovative thing that happened, is we can, if you create a good three-dimensional, interesting character in a really deep world, you could hand it to someone else and it's not fan fiction because the base is there. If the base were weak, those war years wouldn't, and I've not read the war years, but I assume if the base were weak, those war years wouldn't be good.
You know, it's interesting because all of it grows out of the whole newspaper strip world at the time. And the big deal then was to make money as a cartoonist, is what they called themselves then.
Right.
Was to own your own, to create your own strip. And that's how you make money, because it was yours. And while not everyone retained ownership, you know, you weren't going to tell Milton Caniff he had to stop doing Terry and the Pirates. That was his decision, so he could go on and create Steve Kahan, which he owned. And that's what Eisner wanted to do then. He'd been doing the thing with Iger in the comic packaging house, where they were producing comics for other publishers, but they didn't actually own any of those characters. And he wanted to have something that he could own and tell the stories he wanted to tell, and try to make a living off of that. And that's exactly what happened. The thing that he did that was different than everybody else was, instead of trying to make a simple newspaper strip, he realized you could take a regular newspaper, fold it down and have a comic book.
So there were about 7-page stories at the beginning, right?
I think his were the spirit stories were 8, and then there was a 4-page Mr. Mystic and a 4-page Lady Luck story.
Okay.
And so it was a section. So you got 3 stories, a spirit story and 2 other stories. And that's how they started. And that's what unbelievably, I don't own any original sections, but I guess I will someday, but I've never really tried to find one.
I'm sure they're out there. Well, the crazy thing is, you know, and it depends on how it's printed. You know, I've had Scott Weatherly on early on in the show to talk about Dread, and you know, the 2000 AD is that, right? It's an anthology comic where it's like, this is the thing that exists. And Dread is only getting, you know, short sections. And then inside there's a Halo Jones story and there's this and there's this. So 2000 AD has all these short things. And so that idea, but what Scott mentioned is that those early, they were all kind of made to be disposable. They weren't ever thought to be collectible. So if you're talking the original spirit stuff, are on like old newsprint, those aren't gonna hold up. It's not like the way that comics are now. Even that's why finding an old school classic comic is so valuable, is because the odds of finding one that's readable is unlikely because it wasn't designed that way. Where now comic books are made to last.
And you know, it's funny because there'd be no cover either. You know, you can find an old comic and the cover may be worn out more than the book itself. But with a spirit section, the cover is that splash page, that very first page. So those are often a little beat up then, and you kind of
lose. Well, and it used to be too that you would, and I know this because I used to work at a drugstore when I was a kid, and you know, we had the spinner racks and we had like the paperback books. And what you would do is, the publishers, when they didn't sell stuff, they didn't take them back. They just, in order to give you credit, they just wanted the cover. So you would rip the covers off books and rip the covers off comics and just send the cover back. And so that, I know. So
I can never do that. I would feel like I was committing a sin or something.
That's why too, there's a lot of old comics without covers, because that's how it was done. It's like, you just toss this or use it for wrapping or whatever you want, because it's junk to us. We don't, if you send the whole book back to us, we're going to destroy it anyway. So just send us the cover back, so we know you didn't sell it, and then you can do what you want. So there's a lot of those old timey books. I mean, like old pulp novels without covers. And even, I mean, this was, I was working at the drugstore in the 80s. So, I mean, this is something, you know, that was still happening into the 80s and 90s, where you would take an old paperback book and just rip the cover off. And I would just get them. Like, my boss would be like, well, if you want these, they're garbage, we're going to throw them away. You know, so.
So you got a lot of coverless paperbacks and comics.
Yeah, junk. And, you know, who knows? I mean, I didn't keep it because it didn't have any value at the time. But yeah, it was. So that's the other reason why sometimes there's not covers, is because that's just, no one thought any of this had value. And that's what's interesting about Eisner, is he knew that it did. He knew people would, not monetary value, but an intrinsic value to making you a better person.
He saw the form as unique, that comics were not movies, they weren't books, they weren't picture books. It was something very specific and unlike anything else. It wasn't, you know, like any other medium. It had its own advantages that you couldn't find elsewhere, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And certainly there's a lot of crossover with movies because of the idea of framing and setting up a shot and all that. But there's so many more things you can do with it, because you're not limited by where you are or how hard it is to get a shot. It's whatever's in your head, and you can be very creative with it. And, you know, mixing up a narrative that doesn't seem to have anything to do with the pictures, you can do that in a movie, but then there's this voiceover and it's not the same. It's a narration, but narration is part of comics. And honestly, now the art of narration is almost missing from comics anymore. People think it's more realistic to use just dialogue to tell the story and infer what's going to happen. And often it can be very effective, and it's a great method. But sometimes when you go back and read older comics, even from like the 70s and 80s, there's some really nice prose covering some of the book that you don't ever get that kind of in-depth writing anymore. So to really tell a deeper story, it's got to be told in a different way. So that's a long way away from what Iser said.
No. Well, I mean, Claremont is probably the last, right, to really go for it. I mean, you know, Todd, and the problem is like McFarlane, and again, I've done this on the show before, so here I am about to shit on a billionaire, but Todd McFarlane, I think he is the last one to like kind of worship at the altar of Claremont, but also he's the one who killed it, because those early Spawn books are so dense, they're almost impenetrable. And I don't know if you've read those, but
I've never read Spawn.
Okay, and that's fine. I didn't think you had, because I didn't think it's probably not up your alley. But it's not just that he didn't do narration in the way that what you're talking about or what Claremont talked about, where it's like, here's some internal dialogue of what's happening and I'm setting a scene and I'm telling a story while these things are happening. It is, I'm going to think what I'm doing. And it feels like 1970 Super Friends. I should go stop that bus. Just go. We're watching. It's a cartoon. You don't need to tell us. Just go. So I think the reason some of that narration is gone is because it's been bastardized to the point where, instead of it being, like you said, the words are telling a different story than the pictures, it got to the point where it was a see-say situation. And it's like, but if you're showing us, you also don't need to tell us. Whereas with, like, I'm just got a page open to the Pigel when she first appears in the spirit. And there's this amazing, like, it's half a frame is words, and below it is her, and she's like laying on a couch all sexy and she's smoking and she's got her legs crossed and everything.
This is not a story for little boys.
It says, yeah, that's the cover of that one. Yeah, that's amazing. But on the inside of that, you're learning about her and then you're seeing her. And so the thing that she's doing is different than the words. And I think that's where Eisner, and I think Gaiman still does that. The Sandman books, Gaiman would tell a story and then show us and have, you know, McKeon or whomever his artist was show us something different, so that those combined into a thoughtful, complex story instead of Pigel lays with her legs crossed. You know what I mean? Like, that's what Todd McFarlane would do, is he would just describe what you're seeing and you're like, I can see that. I don't need you. So I think there's just been people saw what he was doing, and maybe they just weren't as talented of writers as him. So it was just a lot easier to just fill it up with words.
Yeah.
Instead of being a storyteller.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
I'm going to suggest that her name is Pigel.
Pigel. Sorry.
So it sounds more like a French word or something like
that. That's probably Pigel. Right. Yeah. Pigel. All right. Well, I apologize to Pigel and to you. I'm sorry. You're probably 100% right. I am curious about what I like about Eisner. I mean, you may know this, why this is, like, generally, like, now when we think of like bombshells, they're all blonde, but his aren't. His are all dark haired.
He's got some blondes
later, but Pigel's got dark hair, and Silk has dark hair. So is there, was that just the inking at the time, or what was that about? Or is that just like, I just don't, it's just so funny, because like now it's like, whatever, there's going to be a femme fatale, she better be blonde. And his first few weren't. It wasn't until later that he made that switch. So was it just and this is just out of curiosity, was it practical? Was it just easier to ink? Because he did all the work himself with black hair using the blue than it would have been with the blonde, do you think?
I bet it was more for a contrast with Ellen. Dolan's daughter, because that is his... That is a love interest that's there for the entire run, and she's a blonde later on, but in the early stories it's more of a light red Sandy. Strawberry blonde.
Yeah.
But I think it's more for a contrast between her, and I think you initially see, you know, a dark haired girl. You know, it's not Ellen, but then you know what I mean.
And it just is that a makes contrast. A lot of sense. So it was okay. So that we wouldn't get confused. who was who. We were like, okay, you're seeing the back of somebody's head. You know, that's not going to be Ellen being the, you're not going to be, wait, Ellen's a bad guy all of a sudden. That makes sense. Yeah.
You know, it's Ellen. I mean, his characters are very recognizable. I mean, there's no way you're ever going to mistake Dolan for anybody. Ellen is very recognizable. Of course, Ebony is recognizable. And it's kind of funny, the thing that makes the spirit recognizable is his non-costume costume. Right. You know, he's a guy in a suit with a mask. He didn't want to give him a mask. So he said, well, I'll put a mask on him. This is a simple eye covering mask. So it's funny, in the first, the very first panel of the first section, he doesn't have a mask. It's a spirit, but he doesn't have a mask. So of course we're going to get the origin in the episode, in that story, but there's no mask there. So he got to draw him once without the mask.
Right. Well, that whole first one, right. And it's funny because wow, you look exactly like Denny Colt, but you have a mask. I mean, you're even wearing his clothes and his signature red tie. That's weird. Yeah.
And Dolan figures it out in like 2 seconds. You know, well,
yeah. What kind of shitty police detective would he be? And it's funny, was that, because these are happening simultaneously, is that a jab at Commissioner Gordon?
How are you such a good
detective and you can't figure this out?
I don't know. I don't think so, because I think with the spirit, they literally were close already. They knew each other.
They were friends. That's true. Yeah, yeah.
And I think, you know, I don't think early on, you know, in 1940, Batman, when the first spirit came out, Batman have only been around for about a year. I don't know how much one-on-one time Bruce or Batman and Gordon had to he would have had the opportunity to really break it down. Because in those early Batman stories, which I've read many of as well, there's not a whole lot of Gordon. He's around, but he's not a big player. He's, you know.
Well, those were original. That was a detective comic. That's true. Yeah. It was Bruce trying to, and Bruce had guns in those early days too.
It's a bit different. So I don't think it's quite that. I think he was just being logical because he didn't want to have he didn't want that to be a gag. You know, who knows who's the spirit? Oh my gosh. Yeah. Everybody knows who he is. Well, everybody knows who he is. It's like, because that wasn't what was important to him. What was important was the stories he was telling, not, you know, the superhero shtick that all the regular comics had.
Right, because the thing about the spirit, and this is what I find interesting about him as a character, is he works with it's almost like the 66 Batman used a lot of that. Like, there's a bat phone, you know, like, and the 66 Batman, they could pick it up and just get hold of Bruce. I feel like, the 66 Batman is almost a spirit animal, pun intended, of the spirit, more than the original Batman comics, because it's acknowledging that like this vigilante is working with the police, and as opposed to working against the police. And what if we just turn the camp up to 11? Because I think, and there's some campy issues here. Definitely the pre-war stuff is a lot more silly. But I like the idea of the spirit being an avenging force for good. He's not ambiguous, right? He's here to help the police. He believes in the police, and he just knows that being dead, because Denny Colt dies, is an advantage to him, right? He can then get away with stuff. And it's a pretty straightforward, easy story, but at the time it was probably revolutionary. Like, we are like, oh, lame, because we're looking at it from the perspective of 80 years, as opposed to like, nobody had thought to do that before.
I'm trying to think. I don't think of anything old like that that's the same way. Everybody else is. I don't think anybody else died and didn't stay
dead. The Lone Ranger is the same origin.
Yeah. Oh, well, he might have got the idea from that. That's true.
But was that before? When did the Lone Ranger appear? That's the only one I can think of. But his sidekick was, you know, obviously Tonto. That's why he's a ranger, because he's a police officer. He was a Texas Ranger.
The Lone Ranger started in the radio in the 30s.
Oh, it was. Oh, okay. So it might have been an inspiration from there. Okay.
Yeah, it's certainly possible.
But there was a little
Lone Rangers real in the, is what is it, his cousin,
John
or
Reed.
is that what it is? Dan Reed, the Green Hornet, that's
Right,
his actual relative. They're
yeah,
related.
yeah. Which I love, by the way. I like Green Hornet a lot. I am a big. I like Green Hornet. I like Kato, of course. Bruce, from the show, Bruce Lee's Kato was just unbelievable. And even that dumb Seth Rogen Green Hornet movie, I enjoyed more than I had any right to. I thought that was so fun because it wasn't trying to take itself too seriously, but it wasn't because again, Kato saves it. Kato's awesome in that. Did you see that one? Did you see that Seth
I
Rogen Green
did.
Hornet?
I did.
I
I
liked.
did.
Did you like it?
It wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be, but I still had, a yearning to see it taken seriously instead of
Sure. That's fair. That's totally fair. Well, and that's just it. This the idea of the spirit being taken seriously is he's avenging force, and he's there to put fear, not to use the shadow, but to put fear into the hearts of men. And he's there. The cops can lean on him, and they can be like, "Hey, Denny, go do this," and we can't do that. And it is such a smart idea to stop crime. To have somebody who you can count on to do things you can't do, and that moral ambiguity that, like, the spirit, and this is the thing about all vigilantes, and I'm just curious your thought on this as someone who reads, like you love Archie, and there's no vigilantism in Archie, obviously. But all these old-timey comics, there's always this fine line of like justice versus vengeance versus law and order, and we see the spirit as a hero, but he's clearly breaking laws. We see Batman as a hero, but he's clearly breaking laws. We see whomever, the Fly, it's Captain America, fill in the blank. So what is that saying? Like, what is the comment that these writers, and particularly Will Eisner, are making about like the ability to maintain law and order? Is the commentary there, police really can't do it, and we vigilante justice is the only way? Like, or is it, like laws restraining us are good, but maybe not. Like, I don't know. It's such a convoluted thing. And reading the spirit where it's because he's working hand in hand with the police in a totally, like, they are complicit in everything illegal that Denny Cole does. And they're just like looking the other way.
And yet there are so many times when Dolan says, if you do that and I catch you, I'm gonna have to arrest you. Because there are times he calls and says, but if you do that, I'm gonna have to arrest. But and there are times that if we get to the sans serif story at the end of the book, we have to talk about the ending because, well, it's not the first time that kind of thing happens. But anyways, I think it talks about the complexity of the whole situation in the world of law and order and justice, and that we have laws to protect people that are accused of a crime without convicting them ahead of time, and we have laws protecting people's rights of how they can be prosecuted and investigated and all that, so that we don't aren't unfair to them. But at the same time, it also shows that there are times when you can't find it out without going around legal pathways. I mean, that's why there's the CIA. I mean, because let's not kid ourselves, they're not following a rule book. They have their own rule
No, not
book.
our, not the one that we're allowed to follow.
And I think it just shows the complexity of it. I think that's one of the things that Eisner liked about life was the complexity of life and the complexity that he eventually will bring to these characters. I mean, at the beginning, the spirit is pretty much a, good versus evil, and I'm helping out, and there's a little funny bit here, some adventurous bit here,
The
and
one that's in this, the silliest one with the dead body on the train.
oh my gosh.
That is just silly, but it's silly, but it's also so tight. It's so tightly written that I've read it 3 times trying to find a hole in everything that happened. But there isn't one. Like, it's so tight. It's so silly. It's so dumb, but it's a gag. The gag goes through the whole book, but it's still a mystery, and it's still like a sting operation, and it's There was, I kept trying, I read that one three times in a row. I was like, okay, I missed something. I got to go back and figure out where he screwed up. But it was so, it's a testament to his writing skill that this gag of a dead body on a train, and everybody keeps shooting dead corpses throughout the thing, or they think they do. And it's just silly. And I know that's not funny. You're like, haha, you're shooting a corpse. But visually, it's funny. But it's also still at the end, you're like, damn. Yeah, it was so tightly done. It was such a, so you're right. There are those
three train stories too. Yeah. There are three train stories too in this book.
Right. And that's right. There are.
I have to go back and now, which is that the one where there's the body, or is that the one with the guy? Wait a minute. I got to go back and.
Right.
Which one is then? And then there's another spirit story that's not in here that is, that reminds me of the dead body story, because the spirit is unconscious for 6 out of 7 pages.
Oh, good.
He's just a body that's unconscious that gets dragged around. And that's the story. And that's not the story. The story is the two people in the that are dragging the spirit around. That's the story. It's about them. But mm-hmm. the spirit is just an unconscious body for most of the story. It's interesting because Peter Tomasi used that in a detective story in Detective Comics about a year ago. And I was reading it. I was reviewing that issue and I was like, this is a spirit story. I've read this before. when I published the tweet and shared the review, I tagged him, of course, and said something about it. And he was like, you got it.
Nice.
He responded, like, you got it. You found it. You know? So.
Well, that's awesome, though, that the acknowledgement that modern day stories are still, there's still a wealth. I mean, 29 volumes. Right. And it's not like these aren't 29 volumes that are 20 pages each. I mean, these are tomes. So I mean the amount they're just putting it out like they did it with Dredd too, like the complete case files where you can just get them and they just keep coming and keep coming. And of course, obviously the spirit isn't being made anymore. You know, but there's so much there. And I'm definitely, having read this and done some research around, I really, really enjoyed reading this. And you're right. There's plenty of Batman influence, even though they were happening at the same time. I still feel like Will Eisner's spirit is more of an inspiration for the modern day Batman than the old Batman is. I think the complexities of the stories, the stuff that Will Eisner was willing to do, people die. They're complicated relationships. The Silk,
a lot of people die.
A lot of people die. You know, Silk as Catwoman, right? Uh-huh. I mean, like, I feel that the modern day relationship that Bruce and Selina have, and the relationship that I'm reading back in 1941 when Silk first comes in, or 42 when Silk first comes in, to, you know, I see that way more than like the original Catwoman, who is just, you know, like all of the original, when you think about the Batman's rogues gallery, who they are now.
Yeah. It's very different who they were way back then. Yeah.
But this complex relationship, this kind of love hate relationship between Silk and Bruce, or between Silk and Denny, is very similar, I think, to Selina and Bruce. And then later even Silk has a kid.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, I was like, wow, I just read it. And I was like, and she looks a little black, like Selina has a look of Silk. I mean, that's my read. I could be way off, but
she certainly does now. She certainly is drawn now to look a lot like her with the shorter hair and everything. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So that's just, I just see that as an inspiration. And like you said, Tomasi is just like, yep, I stole it straight from the master himself. So, you know, that's pretty amazing.
It really shows you how much stuff there is in the spirit that is still usable and feels new and different. That's how far ahead of his time Eisner was. That's how much of an innovator he was. Because you can take one of his stories and you could rip it off and people would think you're a genius. And the thing is, the spirit to the average reader is still unknown. You know, creators know. People in comics know the spirit. They know Eisner. But you could do that and give it to your average comic reader at the at your local store, and they'd be like, "Oh my God, this is incredible! Oh my!" And they did that in 1940, you know.
Yeah, it's because it's about his writing skills, right? You said they called themselves cartoonists back then, and what Eisner was he did his own work, he wrote and drew his own work, but I think that's testament to his writing skill more than anything. I mean, his visual storytelling is very good. I think that old time of artistry is just different, mostly because, you know, there's no digital enhancement. It's truly pen and ink. So it took a long time. And so that's why sometimes it's a lot of eye work to get emotions, mm-hmm. where now, like, you know, because an artist will have a lot more time to really get a good facial expression. Where back then it's just like a lot of like what's happening from the eyes up to tell you how you feel. But he does that really well. He manages, you always kind of know where they are. It's really impressive work. I really am blown away by him, honestly.
I want to go back to Silk Satin for a minute.
Yeah, please.
Because there's so much about her that I like, and your comparison with Batman and Catwoman is insightful. And I found it interesting that it's so long ago that he had developed such a complex relationship for them over time, and it was something that builds over time. And wonderfully, this particular collection that we're talking about mostly has what, three or four Satin stories, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it really shows how their relationship develops throughout the run of the strip, which is pretty amazing for comics back then. Nothing really ever happened. It was one-off stories that, you know, but to have that kind of development is just amazing. And something that really struck me when I read through this this time was that how much Satin is a female version of the Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
In that first episode,
they're pretty equally
dies.
Matched. Yeah.
Yeah. And he always makes her. Yeah. And in that first episode, she dies. Remember at the very end,
yeah. Uh-huh.
They go in the water,
yeah.
And but then she comes back. What
right.
happened? And she reforms. But in that first episode, also, the way she's drawn, she's wearing a red suit with legs, not a dress. So
yeah.
So it's almost like the reverse of the tie. So it's the red suit
yeah.
instead. And then the way they're evilly matched throughout the run of the series, and he always has feelings for her, no matter what is going on with him and Ellen, or even Satin's particular situation.
Because she gets married.
But there's a couple times, and
yeah,
she has
yeah.
bad luck with husbands.
Yes, she does.
But not the same kind of bad luck that Pagel has with husbands.
which is bad luck for them.
Yeah, yeah, very bad for them. Very bad for them. Good for her. Very bad for them.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's one of those. I mean, the more I read it, the more I like Satin, and the more I wish the Spirit ended up with her. I mean, but I think it's a foregone conclusion. He ends up with Ellen. He ends up with the nice girl next door, even though I think Satin is more his soulmate, like Bruce and Selina.
You sure.
know, I think very
yeah.
similar, as you pointed out. But the more I read it and read it, you know, I really, really like her as a character because of all the things she goes through and how that's developed over time.
Yeah, and
all
I think
in short, 7 pages.
Right. Well, that's the other thing is that Eisner's ability to trust his reader, to even if you have it, and again, it's a testament to his writing. So even if you were coming in, Neil writes at the beginning how he got his first Spirit comic in 1976, and that it was just like a reprint of something completely out of order. And you know, when we were kids, you would read whatever your first comic was, wasn't the issue one, and it's so. The frustrating thing about everything needs to be a number one to be a way in, which is unfortunate but true. If you aren't on with Rebirth, if you miss the beginning of Rebirth, it's hard to get in. If you weren't on at the beginning of the New 52, it was hard to get in. But pre-New 52, which is what DC was trying to eliminate, you could, whatever our first comic was, it was told in a way that you could just trust the reader and then know there's a backstory and you can go find it. So because if you were to meet Silk and Denny in the 50s, their relationship is way more complex than it was in 1940 when we first see them. However, it's written in such a way that you understand in 7 pages there's a backstory. And then when you go find it and read it out of order, you're like, oh, okay, cool. Now that makes even more sense. But because he's not dumbing it down to us, and it's not, there's no Easter, like the idea of Easter eggs are awesome, but it's also problematic. So you're like, I'm gonna stick all these Easter eggs in there, and it's only for the people who've seen it before. And I think it was Stan Lee who always said, you always have to pretend that the first comic is somebody's first comic. Whatever comic it is, if it's issue 1 or issue 45, yeah, it's somebody's first comic. And that's obviously Will Eisner's style. Well, I don't think comics are written that way anymore.
No, they're not. And if I stumble across one in my reviewing that I feel like is written that way, I always try to say something about it, because they're it's part 4 of a 12-part, you know, storyline, and it's like,
yeah,
you know, and sometimes you can't infer things in today's comics, but it's a lot harder. I mean, it just feels like you're thrown in, and maybe it works, maybe it doesn't for you. I don't know. That's probably why, like, graphic novels trades are so people trade weight, because they're like, well, I'll just get the collect edition and try that out instead of, I mean, when you get somebody, try to get them in the comics, you never go, okay, let's go to shop and we're going to pick up Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman and the Flash and Captain America. This, you go, oh, get this collection, start with this. And then you get like a whole story as opposed to an issue here or there, which is not how it was when we were kids. We were all,
right,
here, read this. Oh, this is a great issue. Read this. And you can have a whole beginning, middle, and end in a story in a single issue back then, but now you don't. Now it's just like, you feel like you took a chunk of a story out and you set it aside and you try to read it on its own, and it doesn't always work.
Well, it's annoying to me because I'm reviewing the Metal Men, which I've been enjoying until I wasn't, because the first 6 or 7 issues, it was Dan Didio's last hurrah, right, for DC.
Yeah.
And it was genius. I loved when he was doing this. He was having this deep, thoughtful conversation about what it means to be human. I really enjoyed it. I was really with it. And then it turns out, whether this was his intent or not, is that it's also now part of the Dark Multiverse. And then from issue 8 to 9, 9 just is my, I'll be writing my review later this afternoon. It comes out today. All of a sudden, the Metalverse, the Dark Metal stuff, and I've not been reading that because I don't like it. So, but I don't know from issue 8 to 9 of the Metal Men. Like I looked at it. I tried the Dark Metal. I didn't care for it. So I'm not continuing to read it. But because I haven't read it, the miniseries, the 12-part miniseries that I'm reading is missing a piece because I'm not reading another book.
Yeah.
Seriously. I'm not even, I was like, wait, what? And it said, blah, 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 Dark Metal. It was like, but I'm not reading Dark Metal. Like, I'm not even making that up. That's happening. And I'm sure, I don't think Dan would have let that happen had he got to stay. I mean, he's still listed as the writer of this book, but obviously there, once he's been gone for a while. So the reason I bring that up is because the way that Eisner told a story like that is the way, like you talked about, the way that he and Silk's relationship expands, or he and Dolan, their relationship, either Dolan, Eleanor or Dolan, their relationship changes. And in that 7 pages, you can still get a sense of who they are. And sure, it's cool to know how it went before, but because they're complete characters and they're in this moment, in this story, we're dropped in and we're trusted that we can follow along. And it's not a marketing ploy. And I think that's part of the way modern comics, everything is a crossover in a bad way, not in a good way. It's not a fun crossover.
It's an event.
It's an event. And that's like, okay, with the Joker War that just happened, that was an event. Okay, it crossed the bat titles. Fine, I understand that happened. I didn't care for that either, but okay, it's fine. I understand that. But now it's like, now it's, I'm reading a miniseries and I also have to be reading a different miniseries. Like that's
weird.
Absurd to me.
That's weird.
Yeah.
That and seems so, like they decided at the last minute, we don't want this to be Metal Men canon, so let's shunt it off to the Dark Metal universe or whatever.
Yeah.
And we'll
It was really annoying. And maybe later. That's what Dan planned all along. I find it hard to believe that he did. He is gone, so maybe we will know, because he doesn't give a shit anymore. He'll be like, burn it down. But
there's gotta be some tell all book about what happened and went down there at some point.
It was really weird, right? But it's so striking to me, because I think he's such a great writer. I think Dan is a great writer, and I think he wanted to tell really thoughtful, interesting stories. Like you said from the beginning, what I loved about the Metal Men from the beginning is the way that he was human. He was telling stories about people. They're people made of metal, but they're still people. They're trying to humanize themselves in relationship to the doctor and in relationship to the doctor's family and who they are. And then you learn, like, maybe they aren't, like, they're disposable, and how do they feel about that? And it was really thoughtful. And I think that's what's cool. Like you said from the beginning, Eisner's telling stories about people. Sure, there's monsters and there's, you know, all these things. And, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, mysticism, the way he comes back to life with the yellow ooze at the beginning and Silk dies and comes back. And there's some supernatural, you know, hand wavy magic storytelling, but it's, the story isn't that Silk comes back. It's how does he react? It's not that Denny comes back. It's how does Dolan react? And the human, like, how would you as a person, the avatar is always us. We're always, Eisner's always thinking about his audience. And I think that's such a smart way to go about it, instead of he's just trying to make a buck.
Yeah. Oh no. Yeah. He had stories he wanted to tell. He had things he wanted to write about people and the way people are. I mean, and you can certainly see in his post-spirit career, you know, with a contract from God and everything else he read after that, some of it was partially autobiographical, and a lot of it was, you know, exploring the people in his neighborhood that he grew up with, and he saw people, he saw stories, and he remembered them, and he wanted to tell those kinds of stories about real people. And he does it in the spirit, but he does it in a different way, whereas later on he just tells the story straight up with no, you know, character like the spirit.
Well, and let's talk about that, the humanity stuff. You mentioned the post-war stuff, like how he changed, and he sees things. So my premise is, and I would like your thoughts, is he's writing this spirit, and like you said, he's telling Central City. I mean, it's like generic name, and I know that's where the Flash lives, is also Central City, but it was also just like generic city name, Central City. Yeah. Sure, it's in the middle of somewhere.
For Eisner, it's New York. For Eisner, it's New York. He grew up in New York, and that's he's writing about New York, really.
Yeah, but I like that it's. By calling it Central City, it could be any major city wherever you are. It could be Chicago. It could be Miami. Wherever you live, it could be that city. And that's a cool idea, because it's like every state has one of those. Every place has a big city, air quote, that this could be. So I think that was smart, because sometimes there's big skyscrapers. In other parts, it's just like, you know, like in the last trolley, it's like two-story buildings. So it could literally be any part of any town. You know, it's really well done. It was smart of him to do that. And I know that Stan always said he set his in New York because he's from New York, but also because he wanted you to feel like you could bump into Reed Richards on the street, which is fine. But it's also, I like Eisner, like, inviting us in. Like, again, because the avatar is always us. So by making it Central City, we could all have been there. But so pre-war, it's about these people living in, you know, living their lives kind of in ignorance of things, and the worst thing that could happen is a jewel heist. And then after the war, the world has changed. World War II, as we all know, and hopefully everyone who's listening to this is aware, the world changed drastically, and we understood evil at a level we didn't understand before. There's always been evil, but World War II showed us evil, and he was there.
Yeah.
Because Americans don't go to the war, you know, not like the way that our British listeners lived with it every day, getting bombed, and it was horrific. So it's a different perspective. The American perspective of the war was completely different. And history gives us a lens of that. We're like, we understand it was bad. We know how Britain was getting bombed, and that Churchill, you know, kept Britain on the right side of things, and it was hard and horrible for them. We know that now, but at the time, Americans weren't really paying attention. We were just trying to stay out of it. And so then Eisner spends the last 2 years of the war there and sees how terrible things really are. So then he comes back, and now the spirit changes. And again, whether it's PTSD or whether it's he wants the world to know, he wants his readers to know what it is. So I feel like it was advocacy, but it was also cathartic for him to tell stories, to make them up. There's still some silliness after the war, but it's a little more intense.
You know, I think Eisner was a great observer of people and the things around him. So, and I know during the war, he didn't see any real action. He was more, he worked for the newspaper, and he did a whole series of newspaper strips called Joe Dope for maintenance, doing better maintenance on your equipment. And that's the kind of stuff he did in the war. But I think, you know, he saw things, he saw people, he saw the results, and because he likes to tell stories about things he knows, he found a way to tell those kinds of stories. And I think talking about how the war changes people, isn't that what changes Satin from being a criminal to all of a sudden she's working for the British government the second time we meet her? You know, even early on, he sees how that's affecting people and how you can use that as a motivator for change. But yeah, I think he saw these things happening, and he wanted to tell the stories about the people he saw. You know, there's stories about war orphans and things like that at different times, that, you know, things that were real, that were happening, that probably in the paper that he was reading about as well once he came back, and how people reacted to things. What's the one story? I don't know if it's in the collection or not. He's a criminal, and he goes over to fight, and he comes back, and he's a hero over there, and he chooses to die over there because he has purpose. That might be in some other stuff I've been reading.
Okay.
But it's just a great example of that. You know, they're looking for this spirit's looking for this criminal that's escaped, right? He tracks him down, he joined the army, he gets to his unit, and he finds out from his unit commander that this guy is a model soldier. He's one of his best. Mm-hmm. And when he gets there, he meets him and he goes, "Come on, man, don't take me back. I'm doing good things here. I'm changed, yada, yada, yada." And so the spirit ends up jumping in and having to help him on a mission for this unit. And he ends up dying a hero there. And instead of tarnishing this guy's new identity, he just lets it go. Because he sees that people can change, and the complexity of that, and how push comes to shove, you go in a situation like that, what it does to you. And he sees that. That's part of the complexity of the spirit's character that Eisner builds over time, is that he will do those gray area things that, you know, somebody is justice, you know, he's
right.
They would never do that, you know.
Yeah,
but I've read so much lately, I couldn't remember.
Yeah, no,
sorry.
I know. No, it's no. I think that's awesome, because I think to me, you mentioned how he was a war reporter more than anything. You know, Al Gore was the same way. When Al Gore went to Vietnam, he went as a writer. You know, he wasn't there, but you're still there. You're still a soldier. You're still carrying a gun, right? You know, so Will Eisner is there. And I just think there's nothing that you can do. There's no, like, firsthand knowledge of something is different than like you said, reading it in the papers. And I think him being there, it changed the spirit. It changed the comic. It changed even the spirit's morality, because his morality changed, because you think you know what's right and wrong until you're in a war zone. You think you know what is okay to do and what's not okay to do until you're there. And so then I think by him, that story you just told, by giving spirit the opportunity to make a judgment call about what is morally right versus what is, you know, law and order right, something we all do anyway. And it's something that people do when they're fighting a war.
Yeah.
It's something, you know, like, I'm sure as an American who went there, you know, because America for the most part was against getting involved.
Beginning. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then, but there's a moral obligation to stopping evil is kind of, you know, the point there. It's like you could, and you can, there's also a redemption arc in the story, right? That you just told. There's a redemption arc.
Yeah. There. Yeah.
That's absolutely really important too. And that the spirit validates that redemption arc. It doesn't happen. There's some stories in this collection that the spirit's really not even in, like the mistaken identity, like the Charles Dickens, there's the criminal and the guy who's married to the abusive wife, and they end up
swapping lives,
yeah. You know, like the Tale of Two Cities.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I was like, hey, he's just doing, if people can steal from him, he's stealing from Dickens, everything is fine. But I thought it was funny because spirit's really not in that, but it's still like this human story about, you know, like you think you know what you want. You think he's kind of seeing the other side, and you know, and even as kids are reading this, yeah, or adults reading this, like being the spirit would be awesome. It's like, even though it's not about the spirit, it is. It's about like, look, everything has got trouble. Nothing is perfect. And you think your life is hard until you literally walk a mile in the other person's shoes. So I literally like that story. And I think, again, as going to the war, you don't know what it's like until you're there. And,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of empathy in the spirit stories too, which I was surprised at, because, you know, you think masked vigilante, there's not going to be a lot of that, but there is. There's a lot of empathy in these stories. I think
it boils down to like the idea of trying to help people,
yeah,
you know, whether it's, he's just trying to, you know, the initial setup is, you know, good versus evil. I'm tracking down criminals, but in the end, it's more of about, I'm trying to help people, whether it's, you know, yeah, the story I just told about the guy who goes overseas and changes his life around, or it's, you know, in the story when the spirit goes off with Satin to help her and
her daughter,
her husband, husband. Yeah. The daughters, but the husband, that husband ended up dying at the end, but
right,
even he has a little redemption at the end in trying to save the daughter, Hildy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, it's all about, you know, how can we help people, that kind of thing. And I think that's kind of the intrinsic aspect of humanity that he likes to talk about.
Yeah, well, I think, well, so we're coming up on the hour mark already. Time flies when you're having an amazing time talking, yeah, about this. This is so fun.
I'm good. I don't have, I'm good.
Okay. Yeah, we've got a little while longer than that too. So, so two things though I definitely wanted to bring up. So just because that's why I'm saying, because we're at the hour mark and I've got two more things I want to talk about. So we'll switch it up. So okay, the 10-minute story, I loved so much.
Oh. What can happen in 10 minutes of man's life. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because again, the spirit's only in that tangentially. It's not about the spirit,
yeah,
but he's involved. And it is such a gut punch of a story. And I feel like, and this, just bear with me, the whole Killing Joke story is stolen from the 10 minutes. Did you ever read the Killing Joke?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
Because
I read it numerous times. Yeah.
The whole point of the Killing Joke is one bad day.
Yeah.
That's the premise. And then I was like, so I read this, and like you said, you read the one and you were like, oh man. So I read this and I was like, well, he's not the Joker, but it's 10 minutes. It's one bad day. It's a 10-minute moment in somebody's life, whether it's intentional or unintentional, can change you forever, can change everyone around you's life forever, for good, bad, for ugly. And that whole premise of the Killing Joke is one bad day, you know, in the Joker's life, in this version of the Joker, in the Killing Joke version of the Joker, he becomes the Joker. Well, in this 10 minutes, yeah, in one man's life, pretty terrible shit goes down in 10 minutes. And it was just, anyway, that's my thought on 10 minutes. And I know that's a big leap, but that's just what I thought when I read it. I love that story because I think, like, if I'm teaching a creative writing class, I would have everybody read this because I think it's such a tight story, because so much is happening. It takes place in 10 minutes. It's a masterclass in writing, but the world before, yep, and after are completely different because of this 10 minutes.
Yeah, I like that he calls it out and says, you know, this is going to take you 10 minutes to read, and this is what, yeah, can happen in a man's,
yeah, yeah,
life in 10 minutes, you know.
Yeah.
But it's talking about people and how people can be affected by things. And I guarantee you that story sounds like somebody he knew that happened,
sure,
to somebody he knew, you know. And it's once again, it's about the human condition. He's not writing about the spirit and solving crimes. He's writing about how impactful 10 minutes could be in your life. I mean, one bad day, 10 minutes, you know, it can change you drastically, but it's just amazing little bit. And that's exactly the kind of stuff that I was talking about when I was saying he's writing about people. He's not writing about the spirit so much. The spirit's hardly in it. There are a number
the
of
spirit the can't stop it. The spirit can't do anything. The spirit is helpless in that story.
Yeah, he is. And there are so many stories like that where he's, you know, unconscious in a corner and stuff is happening. And, you know, it's different from like the very end with the sans serif stories.
Well, that's the other one we obviously need to talk about. But yeah, so I couldn't get the 10 minute, because again, the thing I love about it is we as comic fans, we love this stuff. And we're not stupid enough to know that we don't think Batman's coming to save us or Flash is going to come in and stop a bullet. But like this idea that we like external forces can save us. And the point of the 10 minute story is the spirit doesn't save anybody. He's barely in it. And when he does show up, little impact on the story. And it's this idea about sometimes you have to take ownership for your own actions, but sometimes things genuinely just happen to you from really no good explanation. And you have to almost accept the chaos of life a little bit. You know, it's just, I don't know. It's just so seriously, you know, as I'm developing a creative writing curriculum right now in the hopes of that, like next time I teach a creative writing class, I'm going to require that they read this story. It is genius level storytelling of it's world building. You could spend an hour talking about what happens and what doesn't happen. And all these other characters, we don't know what happens to them at the end of the day, but they all have their own things that happen to them afterwards and how these 10 minutes not only changed this guy's life and changed the spirits. The spirit's now changed, but everybody else who's in it too. It's just genius writing. It really is. I understand why it made it in here. Cause you know, there's a couple of stories that the spirit's not in and you're like, wait, I'm reading the best of the spirit. Why would they pick this? Like, oh, it's really the best of Will Eisner, isn't it? It's just, this happens to be.
It's the best of the stories that were in the spirit section by Will Eisner.
That's right.
Called under the banner, the spirit. Well, it's amazing how he fills in that guy's background too, in the short with all the different people in it that talk about, I don't remember the main character's name, but they talk about what he was like as a kid, what he did. Oh, you're like this. Oh, and the other couple come into the soda shop and
they
feel, oh, you're always a nice guy. What's going on? And then you really feel
his name is Freddie. Yeah.
You feel so bad for him.
Oh,
because and you're like, how did this guy who was apparently that everybody thought the best of end up, you know, with this 10 minutes being, you know, the thing that changes his life for the worst. It's
like it's amazing.
It was great.
It's a masterclass. So again, it goes back to what we started with is, you know, why is it called the Eisner? Well, this is why. You know, it's not just, and again, I know you didn't care for the spirit movie. Because I thought it was farce, I thought it was supposed to be silly. Like I thought Samuel L. Jackson cranked it up to 11 and just stayed there the whole time. I thought that was an intentional action. Cause you know, this is Frank Miller's first movie he directed by himself. He did Sin City with Rodriguez. Yeah. And so he didn't really know what he was doing. So I feel like he hired these amazing actors, right? He hired Sarah Paulson, he hired Sam Jackson, he hired Scarlett Johansson. Cause he was like, I'm gonna trust these other people to just do the right thing. And Sam Jackson's Octopus is, and I know it's like Dread, like in the comic, you never see Octopus's face. So to see his face, it's like when Stallone takes the Dread helmet off, you're like, what the hell? But I just thought it was silly, good fun that was nothing like, it was nothing like the spirit at all, but it was other than in name, it should have been called something else. But I don't think they could have made the movie if they would have called it something else.
Well, you know, it's funny. Originally it was going to be called Will Eisner's Spirit. The spirit, but
was
after
it
got made, they took the Will Eisner bit off it.
They should have, because it's nothing like Will Eisner.
Nothing to do with Eisner. No, I every time I'd see a trailer or something, I just got worse and worse vibes. And this is
did you watch it
good.
Though?
I did. I had to do it with some help, but I did. I did
some help. Captain Morgan sat with me while I.
something like that.
Yeah.
And I was just, that was at a point where I hadn't learn my lesson yet that if I see trailers and I don't think I'm going to like the movie, then I just don't go. I was still at the point, well, oh, it's the spirit. I've got to see it. Oh, I still have to see it because it's a spirit. Oh, my God. You know, yeah, I shouldn't have.
It's absurd. It's to me, bananas.
And I just don't see how Miller, a self-professed Eisner fan, could come up with that. How he could say he loves Eisner and, you know, and then not only not do justice to it, but change it so much that it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, because you didn't ask me how I first discovered the spirit, and that's usually how you start your shows.
Yes, I didn't. Sorry.
I discovered the spirit at 13.
What?
That's okay. I was ready.
Tell us that. 13. Sorry, I ruined that. Yes, how?
I am. For whatever reason, in my comic book shop, I saw this. And nice. I picked it up and
the
started
spirit
thumbing
magazine.
Through it.
Nice.
Yeah. And,
is that Harvey?
I was like, no, it's Kitchen Sink.
Kitchen Sink. Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. And I don't remember if there's a good interview in this one or not, but it's got like four or five stories reprinted. It is. It's a C.C. Beck. It's an interview with C.C. Beck with Eisner interviewing C.C. Beck and creator of Captain Marvel for people who don't know. And I was interested in reading that and I got it. I read it and immediately was hooked. And I was 13, so I was like in seventh or eighth grade.
Wow.
And unfortunately, that was the last issue of the Spirit magazine. But the very next month or 2 months, they started reprinting all the post-war spirits in a comic. I'm showing this for your sake.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
Can see it. And so this is the first thing Eisner did after the war when he came back. And it's the first issue is a first story is a Christmas story.
Right.
And
yep,
we have to at least touch on his Christmas stuff for briefly. But yeah, at that point I just started getting the reprints and I went back and found other Spirit magazines. I got it was started reprinting by Warren, who did Creepy and Eerie in the 70s. So it was a big magazine style and then eventually Kitchen Sink took over it. But what does that have to do with what we were talking about? How did I get
We were just talking.
Sidetracked?
It's fine. It's all good.
Oh. So here I am. I've been reading The Spirit and been a fan.
Oh, we were talking about the movie. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you were 13.
30 years.
Yeah,
we
right.
Average 30 years. Okay. And then Miller, who says he's a big Eisner and Spirit fan, comes up with that. It just didn't make any sense. And the octopus is not supposed to be a known quantity.
Right.
And I can't even remember. Was the octopus in this book? We did.
No, I think at the very end, kind of, I think octopus is mentioned, but yeah.
In the Pagel story or something?
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah.
And
it's not
so weird.
He's not in it hardly at all. Yeah.
Yeah. And even that that's his greatest nemesis. He doesn't make the best of because that's not the kind of stories Eisner was telling. So I didn't expect to get a movie like Rat-a-tat-tat, you know, the toy machine gun in the Spirit movie. But I did hope we would get something more thoughtful, some depth. And I mean, you have the Sans Serif story, which is a good.
That's in there. Yeah, I wonder if that, this is my theory. I wonder if, we'll talk about Sans right next. This will be our transition. So the Sans Serif story is the soul of the Spirit movie, but then the octopus stuff happens and Sam Jackson at 11. And I almost wonder if Miller wanted to tell this one story and, you know, he likes to thumb his nose at people and they're like, we don't like this. So he added all the other nonsense to maybe, you know, like as a, I have no idea, but it could be because it feels like it's two movies.
That's true. It does. I almost felt like he wanted to try to work in as much as he could with as many different spirit.
That's probably true.
Because
Alan Dolan's in it. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. He kind of has Scarlet is essentially playing a version of Silk in that. Oh, I lost your sound.
Yeah, Silk can floss, but that's a different character. That's a different spirit character.
Oh, that's right. Okay, that's right. Yep.
So those are all actual characters from the different spirit stories, but he just tried to weave some kind of crazy thing and giving him superpowers and stuff. All that is just, that is not as far away from the spirit as possible, you know? So
yeah, he gives him Wolverine's healing factor.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, why do that? This is not the spirit. But anyways, Sans Serif.
Let's talk about her. Yes.
There is, I'm going to tag it one more time with Miller and point out that the Sans Serif story was Miller's inspiration for the Daredevil Elektra storyline.
Sure. I believe that. That makes a lot of sense.
The Sans Serif story was actually not, it wasn't even originally a spirit story. It was another character he was working on trying to develop called John Law. And unfortunately, he drew him almost identically, but he had an eye patch instead of a mask, and he smoked a pipe like Dolan. But that was originally the first two John Law stories that he later adapted to the spirit.
Really? Wow. Yeah. Okay. So tell him. So why do you think? Because she comes in the best of. They wait till the end. She doesn't come up until the last two stories of the best of. So what is it about the sand? And I guess I don't know when in time, and you will know that when in time she showed up, like she's a post-war.
Yeah, it's not only a post-war. I think it's already, I'm going to look into the exact date because they have the dates in here.
Oh, okay.
Those two stories are from 1950.
So oh, 1950. Oh, okay.
Yeah, very near the end. And, you know, the very end when he has the opportunity to capture Sand, he lets her go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I think he's trying to say he believes that there's a chance for Sand to still become a better person because he's known her since they were kids. You know, most of that story, a lot of that story takes place in flashback. And
right, yeah, And that shows up in the movie, like, beautifully. I think they did a really nice job.
Yeah, yeah.
And even with the actors that they got to play the younger versions of them, of Denny and Sant, were really good likenesses of them as adults. I think that was good casting, at least. At least you'll give the movie that was good casting.
But we see it in other stories that where he makes that judgment call. And I think a lot of this one is based on nostalgia or memories and always still having that feeling for Sam that he's held for so long. And it just goes, and I think in the broader aspect, it shows about the complexity of human emotions. And not just, you might have a soft spot because of what happened in the past, but that there are many different people in your life that are going to affect you and have a place in your heart that may not be the person you end up with. But, you know, there's always going to be a place. Satin's always going to be special to Denny. So is Sand, even if Sand is never going to come back to being that little girl. She's there, you know, because of the experiences they had together. And then you've got the more traditional love interest in Ellen that as we don't get any of it really a lot in this book, but and throughout the rest of throughout the run, she's always there as his, you know, de facto girlfriend. He never has another girlfriend. He's just other femme fatales, as you will, that come into his life that either affect him or just annoy the crap out of him.
Well, but I think there's a comment. I think there's two comments there that you can make about Sand and Silk and Pujol, juxtaposed to Ellen, is that the commentary about like the thing that you think you want versus the thing that you need. And also, right. And also, like you said, on paper, and in your heart, you want him with Silk. Because she's his equal in every way. But he doesn't, mm-hmm. his life is already pretty dangerous and everything. So maybe he doesn't need an equal. Maybe he doesn't need to go out with someone who's also punching people in the mouth. Maybe the best thing for him is to have someone who's like an Alfred, you know, more than a Catwoman. So Ellen can be that to him, can be a stabilizing force, somebody to come home to. If your partner, your romantic partner, is also out, you know, doing dangerous things, there's no off switch. It's not like, you don't imagine Bruce and Selena sitting at home playing Monopoly, right? They're not having quiet time at home because that's not who they are. So, but you know, they both need that. You need an off switch. So I think that's where he gives you these three characters, these three female possibilities for him that he rejects, sometimes not out of his own volition, sometimes he's rejected. Or, you know, in the case with Sand, yeah. they've grown apart. And I also think there's also a lovely commentary there for me, his relationship with Sand is, you know, you grow up, you aren't the same person you were. And I think the commentary of Will Eisner in 1950, you're saying, is 10 years later, he's been through a war, the country's not the same, we aren't the same. This nostalgic look back, this, oh, back in the days when things were great. There's an excellent commentary there about his relationship with Sand is, we see things, hindsight, they say hindsight is 20/20, but it's not. Hindsight is often hazy and rose-colored. We think yeah, about, oh, yeah. and I, like you and I did, we were grumpy old men, and we do this in our Slack channel, we grumpy old man all the time in our Slack channel. And it's like, and then Derek will do the old man shakes fist at sun from The Simpsons. But like, the thing about it is, the reason we do that is because we have a soft spot in our hearts for the way things were, things we liked. And obviously that's not what people now like. It's okay if people now yeah. don't mind that their comic book, that they need to buy 14 comic books to know what the hell is going on, that's great. But we're, you know, and so I just think Eisner with the Sans Serif story is also saying like, the present that you're in is the present that you're in. You can't live in the past. And the past yeah. has made you who you are, but it's also okay to let that go and be a new person. And I think literally he lets Sand go. So I mean, that's what I like about the Sans Serif story is he's telling us it's okay to let stuff go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not everything old is good for you.
Yeah. And one another great example of just storytelling, and you know, these are two episodes that go together. So 14 pages for all that in 14 pages, it's incredible.
Amazing.
Depth.
It is. It's amazing. And I know you wanted to talk about the Christmas one, so let's do that quickly, and then we will have to wrap it up because I've got to be somewhere in a few. So okay. I'm not a big Christmas fan, so I have to be frank, that's not my favorite story, but let's hear about it.
It's one of those, it's not that particular Christmas story, it's just the notion of every year he did a story for Christmas called The Christmas Spirit.
He did.
Yeah.
I did not know that. Oh.
And that it was his way of talking, even though he was a Jewish man who wasn't Christian, who didn't celebrate Christmas like a Christian holiday, he felt that the goodwill that traditionally comes out of Christmas time was important. And so every Christmas, the spirit doesn't fight crime. He lets the spirit of Christmas fight crime. So he would tell these stories about people who have a choice to make, and the spirit of Christmas always takes over and ends up making things right. And it's just such a unique idea. There's actually a collection of the Christmas spirit called the Christmas Spirit.
Really?
That
nice.
Collects all the Christmas stories. Yeah.
All and right. Well, that makes me like it a little bit more, knowing that it was a thing he did all the time.
Yeah, it wasn't like a single story. It was a theme he repeated every year, and it's just some of them are just so heartwarming, and you know, oh gosh, you know, there's hope for humanity after all, kind of thing. But that's really what he's writing about. It's all part of that humanity thing, and how do you get, you know, a hardened criminal to give up his money to let some guy have an eye operation. You know, I think that's the story, one of the stories we had, you know, how does that happen? And so, you know, throw a couple of homeless waves in, and it's, you know, it can be pretty moving. So
that is,
I wanted to mention that because
nice.
it's a neat thing. We only get one of them in this.
Yeah.
But it's an example of, you know, 10, 12, whatever. I don't think they did them when he was at in the war. So that was definitely only thing.
But that's good. But I think that makes it even more compelling because he doesn't even celebrate the holiday, but he sees the value of humanity. And again, like it goes back to how we started. He wants to tell stories about people and people being good. And I think the last question is always, who do you recommend this book to? Who do you recommend this book? Who do you think should pick up? I think this is the place to start. I'm glad you said, let's do that, because you sent me a picture. You're like, this is the one. Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah. And I'm definitely going to, start digging in and reading the collected works, because it seems like there's a lot of stuff that I'm missing, cool stories. But who do you think is best suited? Like, who do you hand the spirit to? And you're like, here, this is something you need to check out.
I think anybody that wants to know where comics got real creative development. Anyone who has a question about the Eisner Awards, you should read this. And honestly, the stories are accessible to anybody. I mean, they originally appeared in the newspaper, so they were designed to be accessible to adults and kids. And that's a pretty brilliant thing, is that kids could read it, adults could read it, and they're going to get something different out of it. There might be some crossover there, but it by the end, you can tell he's writing for adults. He's not writing for little kids, you know. In the beginning, they're basic adventure stories, but by the end of the book, when Sans Serif, there's enough, you know, emotion and angst in there for an adult to be, you know.
But it's a good lesson for kids too. It's a good lesson for kids too about letting, you know, about like growing up, and it's okay to grow apart, and your best friends when you were 10 may not be your best friend when you're 20 or 30 or 40, and that's okay. It's excellent. I'm so glad we've done this. And I hope we didn't really spoil much. I mean, we know that he let Sand go, and we know that he doesn't end up with Silk, but you knew that from page one. I mean, there's nothing about this that makes you think, but you want it. And there's nothing that's going to make you not want it any different, any less. It is really excellent work. There's some problems, you know, we didn't even talk about really with Ebony, but I feel like he only appears in two issues of this. And Eisner had acknowledged that it was, he wanted to make people uncomfortable with Ebony. Like, that was an intentional thing on his part, to make you realize that you should feel uncomfortable. So I think that's genius. I mean, that's the stuff I've read. Is that true?
I haven't read that. I just know that in my own assessment of it, that after he came back from the war, he did phase Ebony out and replace him with a different young sidekick named Sammy, who was a little white kid, but he still drew him oddly with big white cheeks and stuff. I don't know, the thing that strikes me most about Ebony is, if you just read the stories and try to take some of the visuals and affected language out, Ebony is treated just as positively and like one of the gang as anybody else. He goes to the Dolan's house all the time. Mm-hmm. He hangs out. The spirit relies on him. He's never treated second class,
right,
within the context of the stories. Right. Now, his depiction is a caricature.
It's problematic.
His language is but that's also what Eisner probably heard growing up in New York in the 30s and 20s. You know, those are the kinds of, you know, African-Americans he would have met with, who spoke like that, mm-hmm. perhaps.
Yeah. Well, what I've read is that he intentionally did that's, and again, it could be myth, but that's what I've heard, is that he, like you said, he wasn't a racist. He was a minority himself. He was Jewish. So I feel like he was using an African-American caricature, which is the word you used, which is true, which is what he did on purpose. And then, like we talked about from the beginning, the CSA difference. He's the actions of the character are heroic and equal to anyone, while the way he looks is different. And so he's throwing that juxtaposition at you. The first time we see Silk, she's dressed like a man.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like she's not, she's just in a suit, but she's in a man's suit. And so he's always throwing these visual inconsistencies at us. And then, you know, and then we see Silk later and she's in a dress and she looks, you know, she's super feminine and whatever, but the point of showing her in pants at the beginning is she's just as tough as anybody else. And so I think with Ebony, yeah, it was the same thing. It's like, I'm going to show you this caricature, but I'm going to treat him differently so that you're like, wait a minute, this, the way he looks, and this is his, these two things are incongruous. And I think that was, that my feeling was that was intentional. Maybe I read something, you know, I wasn't like wish searching. I was just doing some research.
I haven't read everything about
him. Sure.
I haven't read everything about him. So
yeah, me neither.
It's possible. Yeah. Said something along those lines at some point. I just know I haven't personally read that one. Yeah. I just know I read the other one about, you know, wanting to change things after
and
it
I
came
think
back
that's,
because he realized the, you know, how it looked.
Yeah, it looks bad. It really does. So, and there's other African American characters in the book who don't look like Ebony.
Yeah.
So it's not as though, so that's what, again, you know, with the fact that it was an intentional thing, you know, and again, it's all through this lens. We're not saying there's no problems with this book. We're not saying it's perfect, but we're saying it's important to read. It's a history lesson. And I think, as our crossover to your new show that will be coming shortly to Comics in Motion, I think this is the best place to start. Classic comics couldn't exist. I mean, things happened before this, obviously, but the modern foundation of comics don't exist without the spirit. He changed, Will Eisner just changed everything. He didn't invent comic books. So you're like, why are the awards named after the person who didn't do it first? But, you know, like the Poe Awards for detective fiction named after Poe, because he invented detective fiction, but it's not, he made modern comics what they are. We don't move to the Silver Age without him, right?
No, I think what I've read is that he invented the language of comics.
Yeah, that's well said.
That's what he did. That's what he did. That's why it's so important. He didn't create the form, but he invented the language or develop the language to. We talked about the spirit movie. There was a spirit television movie in the early 90s that is worth checking out. It stars,
okay,
Sam Jones, who was Flash Gordon, Nana Visitor, who was on Star Trek. She was Ellen. And it's better than the spirit movie from Frank Miller.
I will definitely find it. I will find it.
I'm on Twitter at MattB_Lloyd. I'm on DC Comics News with reviews and news editing weekly. I'm always sharing my reviews on Twitter, so you can find what I'm currently reviewing and either lauding or disparaging. Apparently, I do a lot of both.
There's nothing wrong with that. You're honest. A good critic doesn't love everything.
No, it's and when I really love something, I really love it. I mean,
me too.
The spirit is something I really love, and it's just so nice to go back and reread it because you kind of forget how darn good it is.
I know, it is amazing. Can't thank Matt enough. He's the best. Watch this space for more Classic Comics with Matthew B. Lloyd. It'll be coming on this day, alternating days from Superhero for Dummies. So it'll be in your same space. You're like, oh, it's Superhero for Dummies Day. Yes, it is Superhero for Dummies Day, but it will also be Classic Comics with Matthew B. Lloyd Day, because it makes sense that those two share a space because they're both doing the same thing, but from different perspectives. Those Superhero for Dummies show does everything from all eras, and it gives a deep dive, a deep look into characters, and questions are asked. And Matt will be filling in the alternate weeks with Classic Comics information, background, dives like we did with the spirit today, just all kinds of amazing stuff. So as you heard in the chat, Matt does not like the spirit movie at all, and I like it fine. So we're going to end with Christina Aguilera's song from the spirit. So that's what you'll listen to end this particular episode. And again, watch this space for more Classic Comics with Matthew B. Lloyd. Follow me on Twitter at Tricycle Boombox. Go to my website, AR Farina. Catch my stuff there. Like, review, go to Humble Bundle. Click that link in the show notes. Everybody, get some amazing Humble Bundle deals. Support a charity. Support Comics in Motion. I hope you enjoyed this show, and get ready for more Matthew B. Lloyd in your ears. You are going to be pleased. All right. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.
was made that way. I can't help it. Falling in love again. Never wanted to. And what am I to do? I can't help it. I was made that way. I can't help it. I'm falling in love again. I'm falling in love again. Never wanted to. I'm not to blame. So I was made that way.
Hi, my name's Steve, and I'm here to tell you all about the DC Comics News Podcast. Every week, my friends and I sit down and discuss everything DC. Movies, TV and streaming, comic books, and everything in between. But don't just take my word for it. Here are a couple of our sponsors. Listen to the DC Comics News Podcast. It's audio justice.
No. It's audio chaos. These wackos are crazier than I am.
Well, maybe you're both right. Whatever the case, you can find the DC Comics News Podcast on every podcast platform.
Apple Podcasts.
Google Play.
Spotify.
Stitcher.
And everywhere else you find podcasts. So, can I go now?
Let him go. He did everything you asked.